I mentioned Sunday night that as we began our study of some women in the Bible, we were going to start with Esther. And if you had a chance to read that, or maybe it's been a while since you've read the book, it is a great book to teach lessons, especially about how God provides. It's kind of unusual in the sense that the name God is not mentioned anywhere in the book, and yet throughout the book you see Him working in a number of ways to bring about His will. So even though the name isn't mentioned, you certainly see Him moving kind of behind the scenes in a number of different things that happen. And as we look at Esther, to really understand and get lessons from her and her life and so forth, we've really got to look at the background and look at the things that happened. So we may spend a few weeks on Esther, you know, just whatever it takes. But it is a wonderful book. It's a great book just to sit down and read. It's not that long, and you can sit down and read the whole account. It is a book of history. And it seems like its main purpose is to show how God brought events around to save the Jewish people. Because, of course, it was going to be through the whole Jewish people, through that group, that the Messiah would come. And so we see Him acting to bring about that. And so it's kind of a narrative. It's a story, a historical story about how He does that. And He does that through a number of people, but in particular, of course, He does that through Esther. And we'll see that. The time in which it takes place is while, remember that the two southern kingdoms were taken into captivity, long after the 10 northern tribes had been. They were taken into Babylonian captivity when the Babylonians were the world empire. Well, the empire that came after them were the Persians, sometimes called the Medo-Persian Empire. And it's during the time when they were in power that the book of Esther takes place. And we see in Esther one of the rulers of the Persian Empire during that time. Now remember, the Persians allowed the Jewish people that wanted to go back to Jerusalem, back to Judea, and rebuild the temple and everything, those that wanted to. But it seems like most of them chose not to go back home. They chose to stay there in Persia. And so that's where this takes place. This is about the people that stayed in Persia. In other words, that didn't go back to Jerusalem, didn't go back to Judea. They chose to stay there. And so that's kind of the background. It's a Persian influence, Persian culture. and these are a number of these people, not all of them in the book, obviously, are Jewish, but many of them are. There's also an underlying conflict between two different races of people. Well, we don't hear about that today, do we? But two different races of people that are antagonistic toward one another, and we see how that comes to a head in the book. That alone is a fascinating part of the book. We see some of the for us unusual kind of cultural activities that they went through at that time. And of course, this was 2,500 years ago. This book takes place, you know, 400, 450 BC, something in that neighborhood. So, you know, pretty much 2,500 years ago. So it was a long time ago. And a very different type of situation. But even though the situation is very different as far as the external circumstances, the relationships and how God wanted His people to respond is just as relevant for us today. So there's a lot of things for us to gather from this book. So we won't be reading every verse, but we will be reading a lot of the different chapters to kind of get us familiar with what is going on. It starts out, the first two or three chapters, we see the threat that comes to the Jewish people. Okay? There's a threat, and we see where this, as the story builds, it's almost like a mystery story, an adventure story. We see the threat come at the beginning, and then kind of in the middle, it kind of reaches ahead. We think, wow, all the Jewish people are going to be destroyed. How in the world are they going to get out of this situation? And then at the very end, we see how God works to get them out of that situation. So it is. It's kind of a mystery story for us that takes place during a number of years. Okay, so if you read the book, you certainly don't want to get the idea that this all took place in even a year, because there was a lot that happens during this book, and there's kind of a historical break in there that's important as well. So we're introduced to some characters at the very beginning that are important throughout the rest of the book. Esther chapter 1 verse 1, we see some of these. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persian Media, the nobles, and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. This Ahasuerus is, as I mentioned, one of the rulers of the Persian or the Medo-Persian Empire. And this is the one that went by the name of Xerxes, X-E-R-X-E-S. And if you could go back and read for hours about all the different things this man did, accomplished, what his father had started. His father had started building this great big citadel or castle. Some refer to it as a castle. And he comes along and works on it and finishes it, if I remember the story right. And he, of course, is battling one of his biggest foes during this period of time is the Grecian Empire, which, of course, is the one that eventually overtakes his. So there's a lot of battles that take place. So there's a lot of things going on outside this capital. You know, we kind of see just a very narrow little picture of what is happening. But there's a lot going on in the empire that probably affects Xerxes and all of his counselors and rulers along the way. So he's the first one that we see. He's reigning over 127 provinces, and he says it goes all the way from India to Ethiopia. And if you look at a map, that's a huge area that he is ruling over. talks, of course, about Shushan, and this is in the third year of his reign. He makes this great big feast for all the nobles. These were probably not his descendants, but were probably, you know, like lower rulers over all these different parts. And this went on for 180 days. Now, that was quite a feast. I mean, you just think about feeding, you know, all those people over that long a time period, and all that he'd have to do. Of course, he was, as it implies, he was showing off. Okay, he was showing off his power and his riches and his splendor and all of that. So we see kind of what kind of ruler he is. All right, and that has a lot to do with Esther here in the next few chapters. The kind of person he is. Okay, very concerned about how he appears to other people. And of course, he is the ruler, he's the head of the greatest empire on earth at that time. And he wants, you know, all of the people under him to know that's exactly what he is and who he is. So he showed off all of his riches and so forth during that time period. And when these days were completed, those 180, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden in the king's palace. So the 180 days were for those rulers, those princes and so forth. And then he basically threw a party for a week for everybody that lived in the city. I can't imagine what kind of money we would be talking about to do all of that. But it was a bunch. Okay? But that's the kind of person he was. He wanted everybody to know what kind of person he was, and then he had all kinds of riches and all of these things. It describes a little bit about the place. There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen, and purple on silver rods and marble pillars, and the couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. They served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance according to the generosity of the king. Just another display of just how rich and powerful and wealthy he was. So this is a man that, and this really has a lot to do with what happens with the queen, this is a man who was very concerned about people knowing that he was the number one guy. I mean, you could tell that pride was something that just kind of ruled his life. He was a very proud person. And he went to great lengths to make sure people knew how great he was. So in accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory. For so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. So it was left up to the people as to what they drank, if they drank, how much they drank. You know, that was all up to them. Now we come to the second person, second player in this story, this narrative. Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So the queen was also there. And of course, in Persia, they had harems, and so he had all kinds of different women and different from different places. But there was one that was the queen, and that's this Vashti. So on the seventh day at the end of that week, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, then he commands these seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus to bring Queen Vashti before the king wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. Kind of a trophy wife of 2,500 years ago. And another, you know, to him, she was just a possession. And she was a beautiful possession, so not only has he, you know, showed all of his wealth and his possessions, and now he shows off the queen. He wants to, you know, everybody to see, you know, that he has the most beautiful person in the kingdom or whatever. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs, which was unheard of to do. I mean, if you were the queen, you did not refuse the king. You just didn't do it. Okay, it didn't make a difference what he asked for. You just did it. Well, you could see that this was a person that you know, had some moral excellence and had some virtue and had some dignity. And this made the king mad. Well, for a number of reasons. Remember, he was partially drunk. Number two, he was very proud, because he had showed off that he was so powerful and rich that nobody would ever refuse him, especially the queen. So he was furious that she didn't come. And his anger burned within him. partially due to pride, partially due to alcohol. Well, then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice, those closest to him, and here's all these people's names, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence, who ranked highest in the kingdom. So these were his closest rulers or princes or nobles. And so what? What shall we do to Queen Vashti according to law, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs? So, these were the highest ranking ones. They get together. You know, what are we going to do to her? What's our options? What should we do according to law? And, you know, Persians had quite a legal system. I mean, you can see that from reading the whole book, but also reading, you know, other accounts. They had quite a legal system. So they were very concerned about doing things according to law. They had a lot of other faults, like, you know, immorality and so forth, but they were very concerned about following the law. And the king was, even later on. He followed it to the letter. So they were concerned about doing things according to law. So one of them answers, says, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. So their response was, well, not only did she disobey the king, but because the king was over the entire country and all the provinces, she's wronged all of them too. Or that was their reasoning anyway. And they thought it was a bad example. Think, if one wife disobeys her husband, all the wives are going to disobey their husband. And then the end of the world would come. See, that's the idea. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes. When they report King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. So when, you know, their reasoning was, when all the women, when all the wives hear that the queen did this to the king, then certainly they have permission to do it to their husbands. And then it would just be mass chaos. We can't have that, Dean. It's just you and I in here, so, you know, we're in the minority. So that was the reasoning. It would be a terrible example. So we've got to do something. So, verse 18, this very day the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they've heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. So if it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him. And you'll notice how they do this throughout the book about giving decrees and laws. Like I said, they were very concerned about following these laws. And let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the king's decree which he will make is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it's great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. So this was their response. This was their response. We'll send out a decree that says the queen basically has lost all of her power and all of her prestige. We're taking it away. So she is no longer going to be queen. And that, they thought, would be that. They said, you know, that will take care of the problem, or the potential problem, because they'll see, all the women will see, well, the queen disobeyed the king, and look what it cost her. No longer queen. So they said, and then all the women will toe the line. That was their idea. So, he finishes up in that chapter, and the reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Memucan. He was one of those seven of the highest rulers. Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master in his own house and speak in the language of his own people. Each man should be master in his own house. Of course, that was a very patriarchal society, obviously. And they do that a lot in this book about they'll make a decree and then they'll send letters to all. Because remember, it went from India all the way to Ethiopia. That's a long ways, and it would take a long time for the people all the way in India or all the way down in Ethiopia to get those decrees. You know, it's not hit enter and it's done.
And they can't fly down.
They can't do anything. It would take a long, long time for all the 127 provinces to get the decree. Okay, and you'll see how this kind of plays in toward the end of the book. Because communication was slow, all right, was very slow. So we see two main characters here. One we don't hear about anymore, basically. But the king, we see what kind of person he is. He's very, you know, flamboyant, very, you know, power hungry, kind of ostentatious because he wants to show off all of his possessions and people. Enjoys drink, which cost him a lot. Then the other side is Queen Vashti, who wasn't going to put up any of that stuff. So what if it cost her being queen? You know, she wasn't going to be paraded around in front of all these were all men, in front of all these men, and showed off like some sort of prize or something. She wasn't going to do that. So she would rather be kicked out of the castle or whatever, as opposed to doing something she thought was wrong. So she sets a great example for people today, for women today. I mean, Queen Vashti does. She's a great example. And that's about all we know about her. But, I mean, she set a tremendous example, you know, about having dignity and standing up for what's right. And even if it cost her. I mean, she was the queen. You know, she would be pampered 24/7. Had everything she wanted. She gave up all of that because she, you know, she had her dignity and she was a person of character and morals. And so she wasn't going to do it. So that alone is a tremendous lesson for men and women, but especially for women to realize that.
We can't have that.
We can't have that? Okay. I understand. One person wrote, she lost her crown but kept her dignity. And I thought that's a great way to describe Queen Vashti. She lost her crown but kept her dignity. So, of course, now there has to be another queen. You know, if there's a king, got to have a queen. So, what do they do? Well, verse 1 of chapter 2, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom. And again, that was a huge area, enormous area. That they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king, and he did so. This is, in this time period, and it was probably after Vashti's refusal to go and parade in front of the men and the picking of a new queen, he lost a very important military battle. And that was to the Grecian army. Now, he was the world leader, greatest empire on earth, and he went up to the Greek army, and all the military historians said he should have won hands down, but he lost. And so he came back now to his capital, to his castle, kind of beaten down somewhat. And so his immediate, you know, the princes, the nobles, what do they say do? We need to get him a new queen. Okay, he's down, he's in the dump, so to speak, after being defeated by the Greek army, so we need to find him a new queen. And seemingly, from history, this was not the way it was usually done. From what I read, it was usually, when it was time for a new queen, they would go to the seven most influential families and pick one of those. But that's not what they did here at all. Because if they had done that, Esther could not have possibly been queen. This is something, again, it looks like God had his hand in. And since it doesn't say God had his hand in it, we're guessing that God had his hand in it. But it worked, and this was the only way it would have worked, for Esther, a Jew, who was not one of those seven families, to become queen. So when he gets back from being defeated, his close counselors and advisors and so forth say, here's what we'll do. Instead of just picking from those seven families, let's kind of put out another decree. They love putting out decrees at that time. They did it all the time. Put out a decree to all the provinces. Now, again, this goes all the way to India and all the way down to Ethiopia. And bring in the fairest of all the maidens. And let's give them a time of preparation, which was about a year, if I remember right. And let's give them whatever they need to make them beautiful, basically. Whether it was oils or perfumes or creams or whatever. And then they go in and then he gets to pick. So instead of basically picking from a very limited gene pool, he gets to pick all over. And if you look at all the different countries and nationalities or races or cultures from Ethiopia to India, that would be quite a mix of people that he would get to choose from. So it was quite a different way of picking a queen. But this way, now there's a possibility of a Jewish woman to be picked. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been any possibility of that at all. It would have been one of the powerful Persian families, and that was it. But this way, there was a possibility for someone like Esther to be chosen. So it says, in Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. Okay, a new player in this account. The son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. And that's a very important part of the plot, was that Mordecai was a Benjaminite. Okay, he was from one of those two southern kingdoms that had been taken into captivity into Babylon and then eventually taken over by Persia. So he was a Benjaminite. One of his ancestors, who was also a Benjaminite, of course, was Saul. And Saul later has a lot to do with some other people in the story that we'll get to later. So a new person, Mordecai. Now Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And remember back when this happens, when Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army comes and basically conquers Jerusalem and the two southern tribes. Remember, he does that in three different kind of waves of people he takes. The first wave, he takes people like Daniel, remember? Those go first. And then I believe it's the second round that he takes Jeconiah and then these right here. And so that's the... That's where these people come from. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, or Hadassah, that is Esther. So Hadassah was the Jewish name. Esther's the Persian name. Hadassah meant, if I remember right, myrtle, which to Jewish people means peace and thanksgiving, you know, a comforting type of word. And Esther, if I remember right, meant star. And I think that has something to do with what happens in her life. His uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So we will stop there, Lord willing, and we will begin there next Wednesday evening.